This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
Thank you for listening to the Covert Nerd Podcast. I really appreciate the time that you give me. Before we get into the episode, if you can think of somebody that would like this topic that you're about to listen to, please pause the podcast and share it with them. You can also go to covertnerd.net and look at previous episodes and different ways that you can get in touch with me. Let me know what you think. Without further ado, let's dive right in and nerd it up. We're talking first issues. So let's go ahead and we said we'd pick number ones from the 90s and kind of talk about when we first read them or when we first saw them and things like that. And maybe not necessarily when we read them, maybe in the 90s. I think Al has a good one. Let's start with Ninjak with Al. So
yeah. All right. So Ninjak number one. This is this was published in November of 93. So this is when obviously Image had been around and had a foothold for about a year and a half by the time this was published.
Okay.
And so Valiant was really going out of their way to make a push and get themselves back in the forefront as an independent publisher. And they were throwing money around. So this was Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti. And this was right after they'd gotten done with their X-Factor run. Okay. And right before they went to DC to do the Batman run and introduce Azrael. Yeah. And it's a fun wraparound cover too, because it's foil. It's a foil cover. It's a wraparound cover. It's a number one. This checks all the 90s boxes.
I was going to say, that's an amalgamation of every topic we've talked about.
Yeah, right. I was like, that could make the gimmick cover episode we did, because, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Foil and wraparound.
Yeah, and it feels really nice. Like, it's a really good foil. It's really, they put money into this thing, not just with the artist, but also with the quality of this book. Like, they wanted this thing to jump off the shelves and give them Image numbers at least for 1 month. they put money into this bad boy. But even looking at some of the ads in here, you've got, you know, it's reminding me that they had Bloodshot that was huge. They were Magnus Robot Fighter they were pumping. You know, they, like I said, they were making a strong go at a Deathmate, where they crossed over with Image.
With Image, yeah.
They really wanted a piece of that pie. Overall, and I mentioned the lead just before we started, I didn't read this book. I'm very confident that I didn't read this book when I got this book. I probably tried, just as I did earlier tonight. and I'm not sad that I didn't, because I got this book strictly for the art, and it does not disappoint. The art is amazing, because especially if you like Joe Quesada. It's very vibrant. It's very violent. You got people getting gunned down. And there's things in this that you can't, that they never showed in a Marvel book. And he's, you know, there's no comics code authority and he's more or less like unleashed in this and just really having fun and doing all the stuff he wanted to do. But, it's a lot of, the art's great, but the story, I think there's a reason why once Quesada left, the book kind of fell flat. Cause I think He was on it for a couple of issues, but like I said, if you like the art, definitely check it out.
I think the cover, though, you know, we were talking about gimmick covers in the past and how sometimes the gimmick covers don't fit, but I think this one kind of did.
Oh yeah,
because it has a shattering glass coming out at you, and
it does a good job of setting up the character too. Because, you know, you got on the back, you've got, you know, your stereotypical bad guys with their sunglasses and their guns.
Yep.
And then, you know, he's coming through to thwart the evildoers, as they call them in the book. They're arms dealers in the book, but they call them weaponeers.
Oh, weaponeers, huh?
Yeah.
Well, in this one, and Ninjak's basically a James Bond ninja.
Yeah, he's a super spy.
He gets ninja. The ladies, you know, rich, dashing man during the day, ninja by night.
Yep. This book is really checking all of the cliche action movie boxes.
Yes, yes, from the early 90s. So, Quesada, I don't know how to pronounce it. He did this, and then he went to DC Comics. You were saying?
Yeah, after he did this for, like I said, a few months after X Factor, and then it was after this he bounced over to DC. And spent, I think, like a year at DC before going off to Image with his creator-owned book, Ash.
Oh, okay. I never read much of the Valiant universe in the 90s. Like I said, I was kind of a snotty Marvel Image guy and didn't think Valiant was that great at the time. But I went back and read some of this. Ninjak, Unity, they had Rye. It was good. I mean, it didn't knock me off my seat, but it was better than I should have given it more credit at the time than what I did. It was actually pretty good stuff. How about you, Ben? Did you read any Valiant stuff back then or now, or have you read any of it?
Not on purpose.
Not on purpose.
No, I actually like had forgotten about Valiant Comics until you brought it up when you asked us before we were picking our topic and whatnot. I'd completely forgotten that they even existed. Oh. And then when you brought them up, I kind of started looking into some stuff. And I think I feel like I might have come across a Ninjak in one lifetime or another.
I specifically remember seeing a lot of Ninjak in the comic book stores and in the catalogs and all that stuff. That was, like Al said, they put a lot of money into marketing, I think, on this stuff.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to get their name in front of everybody. And especially with like the Deathmate crossover. I mean, I remember seeing that everywhere. They pushed the heck out of that Deathmate crossover.
Right.
But I think they were a good company. It just bad timing, I think, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, they were just overshadowed.
Yeah.
It was the right time to do it as a small publisher because people were looking away from Marvel and DC because of Image. And you know, they had better art and better stories certainly than a lot of the Image books, but yes, they just didn't have that prestige, the name to it. Image was just sexy.
Yeah. It was great timing, but they were just overshadowed by the behemoth that was Image at that time.
Yeah.
And then because of Image, Marvel and DC, I think, upped their game a lot too. And there was just too much is what I think.
Yeah.
Well, like we brought up in past episodes, just the amount of books that were being pumped out in the 90s, it's easy to get overshadowed. I mean, it's almost like the streaming services and TV now. There's too much out there that there's probably a good streaming service out there that's getting overshadowed because, you know, Netflix is putting out a different Ryan Reynolds movie every 20 minutes and, you know, you got all the other crap. So,
Who is Ben predicting the streaming collapse of 2023 or something like that?
It's bound to happen soon.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, Ben. You're like you said, it's like, I probably saw this, but there was just so much out there. I didn't even notice that it was there because it was everywhere. So, but yeah, I think it's worth taking a look at. Maybe pick Ninjak up in a trade or something like that. I know they've got him collected. That you can go find them. And they did some reboots and stuff. I haven't read the new stuff, but so. All right, Ben, what do you got for us?
So mine favorite number one is more sentimental than anything. I did read it, but this book, specifically the silver cover of this one where the webs are all done in silver filigree and all that good stuff.
Yep.
And even they did a gold one too at one point. This book is kind of what made me want to start collecting comic books, and that's more because my older brother probably has like four long boxes full of probably like 90% Spider-Man and the last 10% is probably X-Men.
Okay.
And when he got this one, just the artwork and the silver webs made it, I was like, oh my gosh, that is so cool. And that's what made me want to start collecting comic books is because my big brother had something really cool, and I'd always known he had the books and all that, but never really got into it until I saw this one. But then oddly enough, I decided to steer clear of Marvel altogether and jump on the Image bandwagon as soon as possible.
Yes.
So, I vaguely, honestly, vaguely remember this book. I've read it maybe once or twice when it came out. But this is when, you know, one of the more famous covers, one of the more famous books. It's when Todd McFarlane was doing Spider-Man. And like I said, it was more than story or art or anything like that. Is, or I guess the art, but the art drew me in. But then, you know, knowing that my brother was into something this cool then made me like, oh, I want to get into this as well. Yeah. So, I mean, you got like, I mean, look at those names on there. You got McFarlane, Liefeld. It's crazy.
Yeah. Fabian Nizia, however you say it. Pencilers Todd and Rob Liefeld.
This is the book that launched the 90s comic boom and the speculators market, because this broke the, this originally was the first record of over a million copies or 2 million copies. Of course, that it was helped by the fact that they came, the newsstand edition came individually polybagged in a special poly bag that said first collector's issue. And so everybody, myself included, bought two of them. And then they came out with the variant covers. You had the green, you had the gold, you had the silver. And
yeah, see, I couldn't remember. I don't remember the green at all, actually. But I couldn't remember if the gold was like a reissue later on for some sort of anniversary, or if they did it all as all together when it first came out.
I don't, that's a good question. I think Walmart may have sold some of those in a bag where you could get like a gold cover and then alternate covers with it. I'm not 100% sure, though.
I know I have a gold cover. I don't remember exactly. I'll have to look it up one of these days to figure out what the significance is. But yeah, I mean, this this is what launched the marketing, the market that ultimately went bust, the bubble.
So this is the beginning of the end?
This is.
So to speak.
This is what sucked all the people like me into it, thinking that we're going to build our retirements off of comic books. So, because like Al said, you had all the speculators saying this is rare, it's going to be worth millions in 10 years. And it's like, well, if it's worth millions, but 10 million people have it, then it's really only worth like a buck. So
someone said, if it says collector's edition, it's not worth anything. Yeah.
Valid.
So this came out in August of 1990, Ben. So that's when you,
about the time you
would have been seeing it.
When the first issue that's came about out. The time I would be getting, you know, someone would be getting into comics. I was, you know, seven-ish at that time.
Okay, so here's the original cover. I think this is the newsstand edition.
Yeah,
it looks like. Yeah. First all new collector's item issue. Right on the top.
Yep. All new collection. He had, my brother had this one, he had the silver and the gold. And like I said, I didn't even realize that there was a green one.
Yeah, I think
that's pretty cool.
It was a black with green webbing. I'm not sure, but you can.
That page is busy. I don't like it.
Here's this page, this pullout page with Spider-Man. You can tell this is McFarlane.
Yeah, and that went on to T-shirts and posters, and that actually helped create Image.
Yes,
I'm pretty sure my brother had that T-shirt too.
Yeah,
because Todd saw all the money that was going, that Marvel was making off of that picture and, you know, others like it, and, you know, was saying, hey, where's my cut?
Where's my cut? And they're like, what cut? What are you talking about?
We already paid you, guy.
We paid you, dude. That was in your contract.
Yep.
But yeah, still a good story. They brought the Lizard back. So classic villain. Just a good story. Great art. I mean, you can say what you want about Todd, but and look at the drop, the water. This is like a Ditko. Steve Ditko, was he Ditko that did the one where Spider-Man's trying to get out of the water? So this is, you can, a lot like that. It's like the split panels. I assume Todd's the one that decided to do these little split.
Oh yeah, this book was 100% Todd. He wrote it. He did all the layouts, everything. This is 100% McFarlane.
Well, I was gonna say, yeah, that split panel like that is, might as well just be Todd McFarlane's signature.
Yeah. Oh, and because he was, you know, one of the first rock star artists, and he, everybody knew him, and Marvel realized what they had and just said, hey, man, do your thing. They unleashed him.
Well, he did. I didn't know this, but he did a couple of issues of Hulk. McFarlane did, I guess.
The iconic one where the Wolverine's holding up his claws and you got the reflection of the Hulk.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that until somebody mentioned it a few years ago. I was like, oh, I didn't know he did Hulk. I was like, wow.
Nice.
So, yeah, Spider-Man number one. What, 32 years later and people are still talking about it. We're talking about it. People are still talking about it.
Yep.
That's how iconic it was in the 90s. So, excellent. So this is the book that kind of sucked you in, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, just the cool cover, and then, you know, the story and the art inside was really awesome. And then, you know, like I said, the fact that my brother had it and was super excited about it just, you know, made me go, oh, I need to get into this too, because I'm going to be just like my brother, except not with Marvel. I'm going to do my own thing with Image.
The Renegade,
founded by all ex-Marvel people.
Here we go again. See these little long, thin panels? Interesting. He had five of them. He likes the five because I think the other one was four.
Yeah.
He liked to do that. There you go, Al. Lenny Vernon. You need some Todd McFarlane little thin panels.
We need some split panels.
Little tiny.
That seem like one picture, but they split them into the five panels.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to do it. But you see that a lot in McFarlane's stuff. So, all right. Well, let's just keep going. Let's call this the Todd McFarlane episode because I've got Spawn, obviously a big Todd McFarlane image. Speaking of when he left Marvel and started Image with the rest of the guys, Liefeld and Jim Lee and all sorts of other people. So we had Spawn that came out in 1992. In May of 92, it was a second title that came out for Image. Youngblood number one was the first, but it came out in May of 92 for $1.95. I remember that was a big deal. Like, what? That's so expensive. Yeah. Here I was getting Marvel comics for a buck and a quarter and $1.95. Sheesh. But this was hyped like no other. I couldn't believe how many times I saw it in catalogs and posters and at stores and things like that, where it was just being promoted like crazy. It was totally different. Again, this was the Image behemoth that was coming, the Image juggernaut, whatever you want to say. And this was totally independent. You know, there's no Comics Code of Authority, anything like that. This is the real deal. So, Ben, I bought this one for $1.95. And my current value on this one is $30. So
not bad.
I was gonna say like $3. So $30. That I think that's better than all of my investments in 90s comics so far. So
yeah. So it's done okay. But they sold 1.7 million copies of Spawn number one, making it the best independent comic sale to date. Now that was back in 2019, so I don't know if something has beat it since then, but 1.7 million copies. So it took off like gangbusters. But and this the story is about, oh, here we got Al Simmons. It must be another Al, but he was in the Special Forces. Al, I don't know that you were in the Special Forces, were you?
I was not. No.
Oh, okay. Oh, darn. So he was in the Special Forces. He gets killed, murdered by one of his teammates, Chapel. And so he comes back from the dead to avenge his murder and to see his wife, who he's obviously in love with. But he had to make a deal with the devil. So the devil sends him back as a Hellspawn and gives him superpowers. But the key is when his powers run out, then he has to go back to hell. And so he has to minimize using his powers when he can and can't, and has to figure that out. And so that's how the story gets started. They retcon a lot of this because they were doing a lot of crossovers with other artists like Rob Liefeld and Eric Larson and others. And obviously there was a split between Liefeld and McFarlane. And so they retconned some of this so that the tie-in with McFarlane Spawn and Rob Liefeld's properties didn't happen, so that they kind of retconned that out later. So Let me show you some first concepts. So Todd McFarlane came up with Spawn when he was a kid back in 77, I believe, is when this drawing that he did when he was a teenager. Yeah, 1977. So that's teenage McFarlane drawing Spawn as a kid. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
It's and not then, nearly as menacing.
Yeah, he's not. Yeah, not near as deadly. But you can see he did some Infinity Inc. for DC Comics. Mr. Bones was a character that he drew. And you can see here, look at that at the bottom panel.
Yeah, is that cape?
Starting to see the big cape.
I was going to say, was it McFarlane or Liefeld that just like each issue, like the cape just got longer and longer?
That was McFarlane.
It was McFarlane. Yeah.
He did a run on Batman too, where the cape is just absolutely ridiculous. And there's this one cover where Batman's like on a cliff and he's holding his arm out and the cape makes absolutely no sense. And like people on Twitter have tried to like draw underneath to like show what's going on under the cape. And it just doesn't make any logistical sense whatsoever.
Yes. Yep.
Well, I remember there's a pretty famous panel of Spawn where he's like sitting up like on a building. And like the wind is blowing his cape, but the cape is like 12 miles out from his back. It's just like, and like, well, I said, just like each issue, it seemed like it got a little bit longer.
It's a good cheat. So obviously you can, if you're not very strong with anatomy, you can hide a lot of stuff. But you can also, if you do it right, you can also keep it dynamic. It can come towards the camera and you know, it can just look fun and exciting and dynamic and have a lot of motion while also hiding backgrounds and details that you either don't want to draw or can't draw.
Feet.
Right.
Or trucks.
Right. Yeah. If Spawn were in a Lenny Vernon truck, that cape would be covering all of the trucks.
Well, I was going to say hiding backgrounds. I was like, if you just don't draw them, then you don't have to hide them, right?
That's it. Yeah.
Oh, that's a very good point, Al. Yeah, you're right. You can use this cape to just take up half a page.
Yeah.
And you can just eliminate a lot of stuff.
Yeah, because especially in his early years, McFarlane will be the first one to admit that he wasn't good with anatomy.
Okay.
But he was very good with dynamics.
So he'd cover up hands or cover up legs or something like that. Okay. So yeah, here's, people thought this is where he stole some of the ideas from, and you can kind of tell he did. Then here's that Detective Comics. You can see here the gigantic cape.
Look, he's in a graveyard, but there's like what, four headstones there?
Yeah. Yeah, see? I suppose it's
a lot of page.
A lot easier to draw a cape than headstones.
I mean, you know, you've drawn the main ones. You got the angel, you got the cross, you know. You've checked all the cliches off, but now you just can cover up the rest so you don't have to come up with any more and get redundant.
Oh, man, that's awesome. But, yeah.
But you've taken away a lot of space to make funny puns about, you know, who's buried there.
Right. It might be one of those, because of that, the editors told him, listen, pal, why don't you just fill it up with all cape?
Just put all cape.
Yeah.
We need more cape.
Yeah.
He had a bunch of headstones that said, like, here lies Ivy Lee. And he's like, yeah, why don't you just draw the cape there, buddy?
Right.
So, yeah, the first issue, like I said, sold 1.7 million. But obviously it started to decline later. But Wizard noticed that... It was a marketing ploy. They had some fancy covers. They had polybag issues. They had card inserts, and sales started to slump about issue 25. I think that's when I stopped collecting. By issue 191 in May of 2009, it sold an estimated 19,000 issues is all. So it really, but that isn't, I don't put that all at the feet of McFarlane.
No, a lot of that had to do with just the economy of comics and the bubble bursting. Plus with Spawn, a couple fun notes is like, especially in the early run there, he got himself into trouble because he didn't quite pay the artists or he didn't pay the writers. Because I think issue five, pretty early, like in the first 10 issues, he started paying top named writers to come in, and he was paying them like Neil Gaiman. It paid him $100,000 to come in and write one issue, and that was before any residuals. Same with Dave Sim of Cerebus.
Yep. Cerebus, yep.
Yep, wrote, gave him $100,000. I forget the others. Because they just had a license to print money.
Yeah.
And so, but like with Neil Gaiman co-created the character of Angela.
Yes.
And that's what caused a huge lawsuit. Like there's all kinds of transcripts and stuff online, and it gets into like copyright, intellectual properties and legal precedents, and it gets messy. But, I mean, that first handful of issues, like the first 20 issues, it was a license to print money, and he could do whatever he wanted, and he was. And then, but one of the problems, like you pointed out in this first issue, they established that that timeline,
yes,
in his power bar, and every issue that the power bar was ticking down.
Yep.
And just like they had to retcon the Youngblood characters out, they had to retcon that power meter pretty quick. Like they realized this isn't going to go anywhere, and we don't want it to go anywhere.
Yeah.
So we have to come up with a new plot device and get rid of that power meter altogether, because he painted himself into a corner.
They did. Yeah, they did. And they, you're right. McFarland, just like most of the Image creators, artists, after a while, they figured out there's a lot to do to run a company, and they couldn't do both. So they had to offload the artwork, the writing to somebody else. They just said, you know, Todd McFarland, Spawn, Rob Liefeld's Youngblood, Eric Larson's Savage Dragon. And then they just handed off. Now, Eric Larson, I don't think let go of a lot of his, but McFarland did.
He's the only one who's never done anything with Marvel ever again. Yep. All the other creators have done something with Marvel at some point. He's the only one who's never went back in any way. He also recently broke the record for the longest run of an independent book, beating Cerebus' record, 300.
Yes. Although
Eric Larson is actually closing in, because Eric Larson, Dave Sim did 300 issues of Cerebus written, drawn by, and that's the longest run of any creator-owned book until Spawn. Spawn broke it as the longest-running creator-owned book. But Larson's going to break it because he's going to hold the record of written and drawn by.
Oh.
He's going to surpass. Because remember that Savage Dragon had like 4 or 5-issue miniseries.
Yeah.
Spawn came when they all came out, and then he restarted Savage Dragon, and he's been going on that ever since. So I think it's like when he gets like issue 312 or something like that, is when he's going to something. It's, I forget the numbers, but yeah.
Well, that's impressive. Now that you say that, it's like, you're right with Spawn, McFarlane hasn't done maybe 50 to 60 issues, the whole run where he actually drew it and wrote it.
Yeah. He's had his hands on it, but he went off and started buying baseballs and started a toy company and has been doing all of that and just kind of keeping his hand in the pot and kind of guiding the ship. But Greg Capullo had a bigger impact on Spawn after a while than McFarlane did.
I was just going to say, Greg Capullo did the vast majority of a lot of Spawn issues. And I think you're right. He gave Todd just kind of gave the nod of approval to maybe some minor editing, some story arcs, stuff like that. And then he'd come back for issue 200, issue 300, and, some key issues.
Yep.
But, what's more 90s, though, if you look at this, what's more 90s than chains, capes, muscles?
You got the muscles spikes.
Don't exist on real humans.
Well, and I don't know if it's in the first issue. It might be in the first issue where he comes out and he's got all the guns.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's later, because he realized he couldn't use his powers, so he had to use guns. We got spikes. Oh man, it is very much 90s.
The waning popularity of Spawn had anything to do with that awesome movie that came out?
Oh, yes.
That movie was bad.
Being a Spawn,
he was not Spawn killed groupie. By Chapel, he was killed by Charlie Sheen's dad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh man, so you watched it too, but again, I was eating up Image. I'm going to go watch that. Of course.
No, we all watched it in theaters. You had to.
I probably saw it multiple times in theaters because it was the best movie ever. Plus, as a comic book movie, it was great.
Right. Yeah, that was 1997. So people have to realize we didn't have other than Superman and Batman. That was it.
Well, and we were all tired of the Batman movies by then. They'd all been ruined by then with the bright, colorful crap.
Oh, 97. Right, that would have been the bat nipples or whatever it was. That.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Although, so I mean, even I remember even watching it the first time around and like the CGI when he does go back to hell with a Violator and all the other spawns are there.
Yep.
Like, I'm like, I remember because I think I'd maybe had just gotten into Star Wars a little bit and I'm like, the stuff made in the 70s looked better than this. What what happened?
Oh, yeah,
man. So
yeah.
God, that was such a bad movie.
It did. It, you know, it tried, but there's talk of doing another one. But yeah, I've
heard rumors of them trying to remake it.
Then there's the HBO animated series. I think
the animated series was amazing.
Yeah. So yeah. It was good. I haven't actually watched it, so it's pretty good, Al.
Oh, it's good. Yeah, because it hit all the boxes and you know, did everything the movie could, and just because in animation, you know, it's a lot easier.
Well, and being on HBO late night.
Yeah.
Right. It was weird.
They weren't trying to make it a PG or PG-13 to get more audience. They followed a little bit more to the book, or at least the action and violence of the book was more in the animated series. It was also really that type of story and animation was big because that's also right about when Aeon Flux was out on MTV. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So
you did you collect any Spawn, Ben?
No, I did not.
Okay.
I always admired it. I thought it was a cool character. I just never really ever picked up a book.
But you watched the movie and the animated series as well?
I did, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah, no, it's a good book. You know, it's McFarlane in the early 90s. It definitely checks all the boxes for that time frame. And so the 30th anniversary is coming next month. So May of 22 will be the 30th anniversary of when it came out. And they're actually going to be doing a special edition of the Spawn comic here. So they're going to do a sketch cover it. And so they're going to do a blank cover that they do a lot of these sketch covers. So I'm not a big fan of sketch covers, but you know, to each their own, I guess. But yeah, it's kind of cool. It's hard to believe it's been 30 years.
Right.
Yeah. So that's Spawn. I like
the concept of sketch covers, but I've seen so many editions where people have I've seen it and I thought it was weird where they go up to an artist and want them to draw something, but it's not like anything to do with the book. It's like, well, the point of the sketch cover is if it's a Thor book with a sketch cover is that you come to Al and say, Al, draw your version of Thor on this. But it's like, right. I have a Thor book, but Al, hey, can you draw a Superman on this? It's like, but no. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right.
So because I think the idea of a sketch cover is really cool. But when I see people do stuff like that, I'm like, that's dumb. You just ruined that entire book.
Right.
I don't care who drew it.
Wait.
Yeah.
I don't understand it, but whatever, I guess if that's what they want to do, but they just wrap it up here. They did in issue 200 and issue 300 hit about 250,000 and 60K on sales. But that just shows you again, how big was that bubble in the early 90s on this stuff? I mean, right? You put the last 100 issues to combined of Spawn and it still doesn't even hit the first issue.
Right.
It's just insane how many.
Yeah, it's, and that's crazy, not even hear the those numbers of, you know, the 1.7 millions and 2 millions of this book sold, and then the latest issue sold 19,000. You're like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, like I said, even issue 300, which is a milestone, only sold 250,000. I mean, that's not even close. And this is just an independent. Right. So as we know, you know, X-Men number one sold 8 million. And that was, again, I remember in past episodes we talked that if you didn't sell a million in the 90s, you were considered a loss almost.
Right, yeah, you were failing.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but still, it was you hit 500,000, you had to, or otherwise you weren't going to make it.
Right.
Right.
So, all right, Al, back to you.
Yeah. Wildcats number one.
Yes.
So this one, I was all about Jim Lee, man. I got hooked on Jim Lee with the X-Men, and anything that had his name on it, I was all over it. He could have, you know, just drawn a series of smiley faces. I didn't care. I was gonna pay money.
Slap the Image logo on it, and Al's gonna buy it.
Even better, yeah. Anything and everything, Jim Lee. In this book, it's tough now. The art is still good, you know. It's peak Jim Lee, but the story leaves some things to be desired. It's you could call it derivative.
Not from Image, no.
Well, just, you know, they
were original independent stuff, Al.
Yeah. These guys all had their stride and they all had their groove. And, you know, Todd McFarlane was really good with Spider-Man, and there's a reason why Spawn, you know, granted he made that when he was a kid, but a single character book with and the character has a mask on, like, you know, it works. Yep. And that was his bread and butter. And that's what he stuck with here. Jim Lee was really good at team books.
Yep.
You know, with sexy women and big brutes, and so he stuck with it.
Right.
And so, yeah, Wildcats is a team of specially powered individuals who have to fight an invading alien horde. And that's pretty much it. Like, that's the story. There's nothing really. There's no depth.
No. But you're right. He did the teams well. I mean, stick with what works, I guess.
Well, and it's one thing to draw one character and be consistent with one character on every page and every panel, but when you have to draw a team and they've all got their own unique styles and looks and everything, and now to make them all fit onto a page, that's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, he was really good at it. So, yeah, stick with the one who brung you. But, as far as, like, the actual story and stuff, like, eh. When I was 12, it certainly, you know, did the trick. I was all over it.
Yeah.
But again, I was more into it for the art.
If you like X-Men, you'll like this pretty much.
You would. Yeah. Especially if you like Jim Lee's X-Men. I mean, the characters look amazing. Spartan looked cool. Yeah. They all just looked really cool.
Grifter, I always like Grifter.
Yeah. Grifter. Yeah. Grifter got his own series.
Mm-hmm. And, for good reason, he looks cool.
This team seems to me more polished than Youngblood.
Yes.
As a team.
Yeah, for sure.
Overall.
Yep. Yeah, it's a good number one. I don't know what the numbers were. It came out in August of 92. I don't know what the sales numbers were, but I'm sure it was huge.
Well, this was part of the first four. So you had Youngblood, Spawn, Wildcats, and I can't remember the other one. Savage Dragon. There we go. Yeah, Savage Dragon. All came out in that first run. So I guarantee you this sold at least a million. It had to have.
And with Jim Lee's name on it.
Jim.
And this one, here's a fun thing too. Is this comes? It has cards in the middle of the book. So you got a Spartan card and a Voodoo card right in the middle.
Nice. I don't remember that. It came with a card too, huh?
And then on the this Ben, you'll appreciate
that Al didn't remove the cards to preserve the value.
That's right.
Even young Al Garrison knew this is a.
And in the back, it has a promise of things to come here, with Wetworks coming in only a few months.
2 months? What? Yes.
I don't think that happened.
No.
I mean, it did happen, just not on that timeline.
Not in November, no.
No. Well, I now that Ben explained the reason Wetworks was delayed is because his sister had cancer. I'm like, okay,
right.
We'll cut some slack. Right, yeah. I did not know that at the time, so I was like, what the heck is a stupid Wetworks? What's taking so long? Yeah. Now, 30 years later, Ben's like, hey, his sister had cancer. I'm like, oh crap.
I'm a jerk.
Yeah.
Now, Al, did you enjoy the 94 to 95 13 episode cartoon version of Wildcats that aired on CBS during the Action Zone?
Yeah, you know, I did not.
I remember seeing that, but I never. When did that come out, Ben? I'm sorry, I probably said it.
It ran from October 94 to January of 95. It was one season, 13 episodes.
Okay.
But CBS had a whole. series of cartoons that, well, Wildcats and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, obviously based off of comic books and stuff. And then they had, what was it called? Had to do with Skeleton Warriors. They called it their Action Zone.
Nice.
And I remember watching the Wildcats cartoon, and then I picked up a book and was flipping through it, and I'm like, this should not be a Saturday morning cartoon.
No.
This should not be marketed to kids. I mean, it can be in the comic book, but it shouldn't be on CBS Saturday morning.
No. And Savage Dragon had a cartoon as well at the same time.
What's that?
Oh.
Savage Dragon also had a cartoon. It was on USA.
Yep, I remember that.
It was equally bad.
There's a reason it only had one season, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was CBS and producers or whoever, you know, they were paying attention because these things were all over the news. They jumped on it and said, this will be a huge cash cow. You know, everybody and their mother's going to watch it. And
I guarantee it got watered down a lot for CBS.
And it was rushed and the animation wasn't good and just.
Yeah. Well, and you were, and I don't know if it's at the same time, but I mean, you were also, again, in the competition realm, you're competing against like the X-Men animated series, the Batman animated series, which are both great cartoon series.
Oh, and Superman, Batman one. Superman might have been 94. Superman might have even been around or real close.
Yeah.
And yeah. Easier to adapt into a kid-friendly
cartoon.
Well, and the kids knew quality. They looked at Batman, they looked at X-Men, and then looked at this, and were like, this isn't the same. This isn't good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You could tell it was rushed, but, you know, they were, again, jumping on that cash cow of Image Comics at the time.
But this, you know, the books at least were fun. They were dynamic.
They were. Yeah.
They checked all the boxes, because, you know, some of the characters, you know, like I said, Grifter looks cool. I always thought Maul was clever, where he could grow, and he was, you know, he wasn't just your classic strongman, because the smaller or the bigger he got, the dumber he got.
Yes, I like that. Yes.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. That was a good way to kind of limit his abilities.
Right, but, yeah. If you're sitting there reading and you're like, just get Maul huge, but then he becomes a moron and he's a risk and liability.
So we can only do it. Well, I think Hulk does that a little bit. Doesn't he? Gets more angry, then he becomes more of a loose cannon, but
more of a still brute, yeah.
not on the level like this. So, but no, the action was good. It checks all the boxes if you're into team comics.
Well, and this one too, being a first issue, and you got to introduce everybody.
Yeah,
so like every fourth page is that big check me out. This is going to be on a T-shirt image.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're right. As they introduce each character gets a page or two to kind of showcase them. So we've got introducing all the characters. Yeah. Oh yeah, I remember this. This is a good. I kind of forgot how good this was. Yeah.
I think I still have this one laying around somewhere too.
As far as nostalgia goes, I mean, so we got Grifter got his own title or his own series, and then the Zealot got hers.
Yep.
I think are the only two. I don't know if anybody else did or not, but
I mean, because this was part of Jim Lee, the studio that Jim Lee started was Homage Studios, which eventually became Wildstorm.
Wildstorm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ended up selling Wildstorm to DC. And that's when DC got Grifter and Zealot and all the characters, obviously. So that's, you know, and so Grifter has been introduced. Those guys were introduced into the DC universe. I'm not sure if the others did. I think Spartan has been around a couple other books, but which is a shame because I always thought Spartan looked the coolest. I thought, you know.
Yeah.
I would like to see him go farther.
He didn't, for whatever reason, he didn't take off. It's kind of weird how that works.
Yeah.
Yeah, Grifter was kind of like the Gambit of the team.
Yep,
kind of got that vibe. So, but a good book.
Wasn't Spartan? If he comes across as the Cyclops type, I can see why.
He is. He's a team leader
like that.
He was. He was a team leader. He was also a robot.
Oh,
I see.
Which was an interesting twist.
Was he? I thought he was just a cyborg, or was he fully robot? I don't remember.
But now that you mentioned, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. You got the baddie, of course.
Yep.
Got a Deadpool lookalike here.
Yeah.
Got this guy. It looks like Deadpool.
Yep.
Deadpool, Deadshot Spawn.
Change the color.
Oh, man. Ben, throwing the copy shade all over the place. Aloe test, good artist borrow, great artist steal. Come on.
That's right.
Ignore the fact that he looks just like, you know, Cyclops or Deadpool. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Oh, man. But yeah, Wildcats, covert action team.
Yep.
All right. So last but not least is the Thanos quest. Now, I didn't know this even existed until about 10 years ago, because in the Infinity Gauntlet comic book, they have briefly one panel that they talk about Thanos getting the Infinity Gems from these other characters, and they don't spend any time explaining at all how he got them. So then I found this, and this explains it. So how he gets all the gems. Amazing cover, Jim Starlin, of course. I should have put a Ron Lim in here. Al probably knows some other Ron Lim comics, but he's synonymous with all the Infinity stories from the early 90s.
Anything Marvel Cosmic Universe was Starlin and Lim.
Because he did some Silver Surfer, right, Ron Lim? Okay, that's what I thought. So this one is Thanos Quest number one. There's Thanos Quest number two. Schemes and Dreams is the subtitle on this one, and explains how he gets the first three gems, and it came out in 1990, October of 1990, and then it kicked off the Infinity Gauntlet storyline later. But this one doesn't have the comics code of authority. So they got away with a little bit more, nothing major, especially by today's terms, but they say a couple swear words and show some blood. So I know, Ben, cover your ears. But for 1990,
did this come out before the Infinity Gauntlet stuff, or did they like produce it later to be like, oh, we should explain this?
No, this actually came out before it, but I didn't realize it existed until about 10 years ago. I happened to go through some long boxes at a store, and I was like, what's this? And I thought maybe it's a reprint of something. He's like, no, this is the original. I was like, I didn't know that. So
wow.
Yeah. So we've got a cool cover here. So if you look, there's a little Easter egg that Lim did in the corner here on the little lava. So we have the word Starlin in the lava kind of in the corner. I was like, oh, that's kind of a fun little thing that Lim did. So we've got, of course, Thanos, the big baddie, getting all the gems together from the elders of the universe. And one by one, outsmarting all of them. Let me go back here. So we got Jim Starlin, the writer, Ron Lim, penciler, John Beatty, inker, Tom Vincent. Jim Starlin did the cover. Okay. But going to all of the elders of the universe, has the Infinity Well. He figures out he didn't know at the time, and people didn't know at the time, that if you put all the gems together, you become the ultimate power in the universe. And so he figures that out by going to the Infinity Well in Death's realm. And this is when they're first called. Now, they're all called Soul Gems here still. And then later on in the book, he calls them the Infinity Gems. So this is when they first get their name. Because prior to that, they were just called the Soul Gems, all of them, whether they were Soul Gem, Power Gem, or whatever. But each gem he gathers kind of adds more power to each one. So it's exponential. They kind of explain in the story how each one kind of builds onto the next one and makes you more and more powerful. Some gems interact with other gems differently. And that's how he figures out how to put them all together. A fun story. It's just interesting how they put Thanos in all these different situations. And he's always just like Thanos on anything. He's always one step ahead of everybody and knows how to outsmart him. He doesn't necessarily overpower anybody. He just kind of outsmarts everybody and gets the gems. So good story.
How much of this made it into the Avengers movies?
Very little.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to say, from looking at the pages he's flipping through, I'm going to go with, like, other than Thanos, zero.
Yeah. Now, I guess I would say the spirit is there as far as Thanos is always kind of a little bit step ahead, but that's about it. As far as the characters, none of them.
Thanos collects the stones, wants to be the total controller, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But he's always a step ahead. That's definitely a thing you can see in the Avengers movie, that he knows what to do and how to get him. And he's trying to court death. You know, that's something they don't really delve into at all in the movie. Mm-mm. But a real good, you can see, I mean, Al probably can see, this has got Ron Lim artwork all over it. He just has that style.
Yeah.
But well drawn. Story's good. Art's good. I think it holds up fairly well. But I'm also a big fan of the Infinity Gauntlet, so I'm kind of looking at it through jaded eyes on it. But I still think it holds up pretty well. But good. You can still pick it up and trade. I know they redid it, like a retelling of it in 2017 or 16, I think. But I like the original better. But, you know, I'm old school. They explain where the Infinity Gems come from in the next issues. There's two issues. One thing they did have is the Collector had one of the gems, and then the Avengers, the Collector had one of the gems. So, okay, I take that back. There's slight similarity there, ever so slightly.
Sure.
But yeah, so the elders of the universe are like the oldest intelligent beings in the universe, and they all have the gems except for one. The in-betweener has one. Here's one. The gardener. Now this guy is deadly. Look out.
He looks like Moses.
He's gonna transplant your azaleas and cause your cause your daisies to overgrow.
Right.
He's got his shepherd staff there to keep you in line, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. So all of the elders have kind of their shtick. This guy, you know, one of them was the champion. He was the master of fighting. This guy is the master of gardening, things that grow. So, but yeah,
Infinity Gem helped you with gardening. I remember the Green Thumb Gem.
So this one, the gardener has the Time Gem. So he's able to grow his garden and keep him at pristine growth. So when the flowers bloom, that's where he just stops time and lets them stay there.
The gem helps monitor the pH balance of the soil.
Exactly. So he holds him in time is what he does. And all throughout the book, though, Thanos tells the elders, you have no idea what you have here, and outsmarts him that way. Obviously, this guy is a gardener.
I feel like with the gardener, he was correct. He has no idea what he's got there. You're using that to make sure your roses are prime. You can control time. Come on, man.
So it's kind of funny. But good story. So I'd recommend it to anybody. Good art, good story. Kind of gives you the origin of the Infinity Gems compared to, you know, what we see on the movies. So
sure.
But yeah. All right. I don't know. Have you guys seen this or know about this?
I've not. No.
Oh, okay.
No, yeah. I had no idea that existed until just now when we were talking about it.
Yeah, I was as surprised as everybody. I was like, wow, this is real. Because like I said, at the Infinity Gauntlet, you never really get the backstory. He shows up with the gauntlet.
Yeah, I remember reading The Silver Surfer, and there were some issues leading up to the Infinity Gauntlet, but it was also, you know, it also ran through like three other books that I wasn't about to go get. So when those issues would, you know, I'd get those Silver Surfer issues, I had no idea. So I just kind of skimmed through them fast. And
yeah,
I don't know. And then, but then I was aware of the Infinity Gauntlet because they did a lot of marketing. There was always that image of, you know, and the gauntlet and all the and I was always aware of it, but that was it.
This was just kind of runs under the radar. I don't know that they promoted it much. It was a higher, you know, for the time, higher priced item. Let's say I think it was $3.95. It was 42 pages, I believe.
Well, so, that cover almost looked like it was like a trade.
It was a hardcover, but yeah, it was like a trade. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, yeah, so like the prestige format. So they did, because back then in the early 90s, especially, Marvel would do that every now and then, where it'd be like a one-off story that was like double size or triple size of a normal book, just because they could.
They did the Marvel graphic novels, so that's kind of in the spirit of this one. Oh, so this is $4.95. Yeah, so for early 1990s, this is would have been expensive.
Still though, $5 gets you a big book that size with that one big story instead of having to jump around at 8 different books to collect it. That's pretty solid deal.
And a fold out cover, so you can see here it's a fold out cover, so you get both oversized picture, oversized artwork on the front. So yeah, real good story.
That black and white image that I think's on the interior cover, like right after you had the slide right after this. Like, yeah, that one, that's a pretty, I didn't know this book existed, but I've seen that image a bunch.
Oh, well, see, it mirrors. So this one
like a pretty famous image of Thanos, but I didn't know where it came from.
So this one, he's facing left or right, excuse me, with no gems. And then if you get to the end, they have the same one, black and white with the 3 gems. I remember correctly, but yeah, you're right. That has been promoted a lot. Let's see. There it is.
Yeah.
It's facing the other way.
Yeah. Like I said, that's kind of not necessarily iconic, but a kind of a famous image of Thanos. And like I said, I had no idea where it came from, but I've seen it all over the place. So
yeah.
Jim.
No, Ron Lim. Came from.
Yeah. Jim Starlin. He's the kind of the guy that started all the cosmic stuff with Infinity Gems and whole cosmic area back in the 70s, even, I think, is when he was doing a lot of this when he got started. He's still going. He's still doing stuff for Marvel, I think, right, Al?
I think recently him and Ron Lim they're both doing a Silver Surfer book again.
Yeah, wow. 40 years or so.
Yeah.
I'm doing Surfer. That's amazing.
It's a good run.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, guys. For
thank you.
Talking 90s first issues, and thanks for everybody listening later or watching now. We appreciate it. So we'll do this again. We'll come up with a different 90s topic. We'll see what we can come up with and go from there. So, all right. Well, thanks, Ben. Thanks, Al.
Sure thing.
And we will start the Al Garrison fan club, just like Rob Liefeld did. So stay tuned.
Right.
and then Ben's financial investment services.
Right. Look for my TED talk on how to cash in on your 90s comic book investments.
Yes. All right. Thanks, everybody. Caster with Ben, so
that's right.
That's right. You gotta act professional.
That's right. All that money Ben gets paid.
That's right.
That's right. I've been cashing in all my 90s comic books to pay for podcasting stuff.
Ben's up to -7. build your wealth with Ben Crane, right?
That's right.
All right. Well, you just have to go back in time and get the almanac, the sports almanac, like Marty McFly.
That's it.
I actually saw a funny story. I was leaving my neighborhood, and somebody was driving into the neighborhood in a DeLorean.
Wow.
I was like, who has one of those?
Yeah.
Right?
Because they weren't very good. Like, they were notoriously not good cars.
Yes. There's a reason why they only made like 500 of them or whatever it was.
Yeah. Well,
there's a reason there's a whole warehouse of DeLorean parts just sitting unused.
Yeah. And a lot of it had to do with John DeLorean's debilitating cocaine habit. But
I mean, if you want to get technical about it.
It's a pile of technical problems. A lot of car enthusiasts they're quick to point out that a DeLorean will not get to 88 miles an hour.
Well, if it's running on plutonium, it will.
Sure.
Well, Al did a good segue. Speaking of cocaine, we're in the 90s.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody that's listening later or watching live. We're going to talk about more 90s comics, and this time we're going to talk about first issues, which the 90s had a lot of them. But before we get there, we're going to do Who's the Artist game with Al Garrison, because this man knows his artist.
And I'm promising nothing.
Yeah, promising nothing. Well, so we're going to
deliver. Good job, Al.
Yeah, that's right. Under promise and over deliver. So I'm going to put a page cover, whatever, from a comic book artist from the prominent in the 90s, but some of the art isn't in the 90s. And we'll see if Al can guess who the artist is based upon the cover or page. So you ready, Al?
Yes.
All right. For 1,000. No. Ooh. All right. Let me see. Get it started here. Okay. So here's your frame.
That is John Romita Jr.
Oh, these are going to be too easy for Al. Yes.
With that particular thing, you can tell by the mouth and the shape of the shape of the face, but just his line work in general.
Now, did Frank Miller, this is Daredevil. I mean, Frank Miller, obviously he's taken a lot from Frank Miller's Batman Year One, but I assume Frank Miller had nothing to do with this one, I don't think.
No. Well, maybe stylistically. I mean, Frank Miller was one of those guys that everybody of this era just, you know, idolized.
Yeah. Copied.
Right.
All right. So yeah. Al's got one already. Okay. Here's the next one.
Ooh. The heavy black inks, and that suggests Mark Teixeira.
Yes. Mark Teixeira. I remember, I think you talked about him on one of the Ghost Rider comics from previous episodes. So,
yeah.
All right. They had a one with Ghost Rider getting riddled with bullets, but I couldn't confirm if that was Mark or not. So I'm like, well, I better not, but it was, was probably him. All right. Next one.
Ooh, that's a tough one. The mouth almost looks like Liefeld, but there's feet.
There's feet. So,
anatomically correct for Liefeld.
I mean, kind of. I'm going to stick with Liefeld on that one. Okay. Because it does look like newer, more stiff Liefeld.
This is from 2022, I think. So I know this one, the artist isn't, but... That's Dale Keown.
Oh, no.
I was going to put Hulk in there, but I was like, that'll be a dead giveaway if it was Hulk.
Or Pitt.
Pitt.
Because he was known for his giant muscled guys. That was his whole shtick.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, that's too easy if I put Hulk or Pitt. So
yeah,
that's all right. A good giveaway. A little made it a little tougher. I think that's Iron Fist, I think.
Iron Fist, yep.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, that's Larry Strowman.
Yep. I didn't know if I could put, I knew you were a big fan of X-Factor. I was like, well, but if I do a close-up of just Polaris, that might be too hard, but.
Again, he's got a very unique style. There's a lot of like squared off, it's very graphic illustrative style as opposed to, you know, more of the realistic comics.
Because he's got he does a square chin. You can see on, what's his name? The Warpath.
Yep.
So, okay. Next one.
Oh, that's Jay Lee. That's
Jay Lee. Yeah. You can tell
Especially that era Jay Lee. Yeah. That was an amazing era for Jay Lee. His stuff now is still just mind-boggling and simple and clean and beautiful, but that era was just gnarly.
Oh, I didn't black out. Yeah, he put his name right here.
that doesn't matter, man. I don't know how many times I drew that image. I copied that. Like nobody's business.
Okay. You see that he does. So Sam Keith kind of does this. See the little fabric dangling.
Yep.
So he kind of does that. So that's Chapel from Youngblood. Last one, I think.
Ooh. That's a tricky one. I almost want to say one of the Kubert boys, but I won't swear to that.
Nope. Try again. We'll give you another shot here.
And Jerry Ordway was a big Superman illustrator.
Now, these are more modern. This is from, I think, the 2010s. So might throw you for a little bit of a loop. But the artist is from the 90s. Big time.
Yeah, I got nothing on this one.
This is Dan Jurgens.
Oh.
I forgot to put his name on the slide. But so, yeah, this is, I think, the left one with Zod was from 2017, I think, is what I got, and then the other one on the right there is from the early 10s.
Yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, I never really studied Dan Jurgens.
So I was gonna do the Death of Superman cover, but like I'll know that one right away. So, but anyway, all right. Well, good job, Al. Very good.
That was
Thanks for playing along and showing us your artist skills. So. All right. We'll have to do that again sometime if you're up for it.
Always.
So.